Okay, so it's a as usual pleasure to be here and talk on well, something which is probably related to some of the subject discussed during during this program. Specifically, it will be a relation through possible application of this technique which I'll tell you about to glassy systems, but actually I'll not be talking about that. So for that matter, I'll be very grateful for any comments or suggestions along these lines. So the work which I'll be talking about is done in the course of a couple of years, mainly with Volodya Cherniak, whom some of you may know. He is from now in Wayne State. But also, well, this bigger program was developed in collaboration with Misha Stepanov, who just joined Applied Math at Tucson, the junior faculty. And my plan for today, I'm not assuming that all of you know what error correction is and what information theory is, or what a specific aspect of information theory is. So I'll start from extended introduction. Probably it will take, I don't know, half an hour at least, and maybe 40 minutes, going through various things which are kind of introductory to my subject of this talk, which will be loop calculus. And loop calculus, as I already mentioned, is some new theoretical tool which allows to account for loops in a graphical model, in model of statistical mechanics in general, but information theory in particular. And then, but in the end, and probably it will be very brief, I'll tell you how. So this error correction, and specifically problem of what's called problem of error flow and error correction, I'll tell you what is that, was the main motivation for us to develop this technique, and I'll show you how it worked in the context of this application. Okay, so now I'll start slowly from describing what error correction is. And what is the problem I'll be talking about. So error correction, you probably all heard of that in various ways. So it starts from, well, there are basically three important ingredients: channel, encoding, and decoding. So it starts from channel, and forget for a second about anything smart you do on the level of encoding and decoding. You just have channel. Channel is noisy, which is basically black box. You don't know what is that deterministically, but you assume some statistical information. And, well, just for the matter of simplification, let me discuss this particular type of noisy channel, which is additive white Gaussian channel. That's actually one of the most used model information theory. It doesn't explain anything, I mean everything, it explains something. Many of the statements which I'll be making, they're actually model and sensitive, but in any case, I'll be mainly discussing that. So probability of transition probability, so I'm getting input, and well, I have input, and probability of getting output is decomposed in a product of probabilities of different bits. So bits, noise acts on different bits independently, they're not correlated. And S is, well, it's usually called signal-to-noise ratio, so it's basically inverse temperature for all purposes of statistical physics analogy. Okay, so now this signal-to-noise ratio, inverse temperature, if it is large, probability of error is low, and probably you may be happy with this channel, meaning that number of errors is not that large, and depending on application, well, you may be okay even without doing anything smart and fancy with your information pattern. But it's not always the case. So, for example, for cell phone requirement for this bit error rate, so number of errors per number of information bits, is actually not that low. So it's 10⁻³. So for error correction, well, is of course used here, but for other applications like fiber optics, 10⁻½ is the requirement. So your probability should be extremely low. And noise in a channel actually gives you much higher number. So you do need to do something, and that's how error correction comes. So the whole idea of error correction is you cannot gain in, you cannot decrease bit error rate and pay nothing. You need to pay, well, there is a trade-off. And this is a trade-off between redundancy is a keyword. So you introduce redundancy, and redundancy helps you to reduce bit error rate. Very kind of straightforward and stupid way of using redundancy is just to repeat, right? Repetition. So you said, well, that's what we are doing when we are talking on the phone, and you know, somebody on another line, on another side, on another end of the line doesn't hear. Well, you repeat, right? So that's of course very kind of straightforward way of using redundancy. And error correction, I mean modern error correction, is about smart redundancy. I mean how to play with this redundancy in a smart way. I'll be talking primarily about linear codes. Linear means that you have a mapping from information pattern which is, let's say, L bits long to longer information pattern, N bits long, and this mapping is linear. So you just have a matrix which acts, and matrix is fixed, okay, which acts on this pattern, and you're getting output. Output from encoder, which is at your disposal. And then it gets into the channel. Channel pollutes a signal. In this case, pollution is kind of discrete, so you may flip certain bits, right? It may be soft, meaning that it may be not 0 and 1, but 1 half or 1 third, whatever, any number. And then, well, there is this most important part, most important for the purpose of my talk, which is called decoder. So decoder, the task of decoding is to restore, given that you know what encoder was doing, and deterministic knowledge about encoder, of course, and given that you know, you have statistical information about the channel, you want to decode. Well, you need to do the best you can possibly do statistical sense of this word. So a lot of things will be said later about this decoding. So that's the emphasis of this talk. Okay, so now a few words about what's called, you probably heard this term, LDPC codes, which means low density parity check codes. Well, this low density, it refers to some sparseness in a certain graphical representation or in a matrix representation of the respective code. So let me tell you, describe what the sparseness mean and how codes are explained. As already mentioned, you can describe a code in terms of just mapping. It's called generator matrix. You have the generator matrix which maps your original signal to what will be sent to the channel. But it's a little bit more convenient from a point of view of later decoding to describe code in terms of what's called parity check matrix. What parity check is? Well, think about this example. So I had 5 information bits. That's plus or minus 1, or 0 and 1s. Okay? And you have 2 in the power 5 possibilities. Right? That's, you can send any of these messages. Now what you do, you map this 5 bits long message into a 10 bits long message, n is equal to 10. And therefore you introduce redundancy. So basically kind of 5 bits, they're redundant. But to describe this redundancy in the most convenient way, you introduce this parity check matrix. So how it works? Parity check matrix consists of zeros and ones. And I'm now discussing this V, which is 10 bits long message, which also consists of zeros and ones. So you apply this matrix to this 10 bits long vector, which you put in this case on the right. Okay, and then the result will be a 5 bits long message. And you do operations, which are multiplication, additions, modulo 2. And if results consist of all zeros, then what you gave me, which is 10 bits long, is a code word. One of those 2 in the power 5, which actually really correct messages. However, if one of these, one of the elements in this 5 bits long message is 1, then something wrong. So it's not really code word. That's how it works. And it's clear why it's called parity check, because basically you are checking parities, and all parities should be satisfied for your message to be code word. So that's a way to explain code word or information message. It's also can be, and it's actually most useful thing which is introduced. It's explained in terms of, can of course be explained in terms of graphs, in terms of a graph, and graph is more or less projection of this matrix. So you have bits on the left, 10 bits, and you have 5 checks on the right, and checks are connected to bits according to basically to this matrix. So for example, in this check, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bits connected. So you need to have a sum of plus or minus or 0 or 1s, which you have in here. And if a result is 0 modulo 2, then this check is satisfied. But you need to satisfy all of those checks for your 10 bits long message, 0 and 1 message, to be one of those 2 in the power 5, you know, actual code words. Okay? So this matrix is sparse in the case of low density parity check codes. And the sparseness is very useful and good feature of this matrix, and I'll tell you later why, and actually that's in the core of this talk. I also wanted to, well, I'll be telling you about some tests which we did, and the code which we use for the test is called Tanner code. It's actually 155 bits long, and those are two representations of this code. This parity check matrix, and this is graphical representation of what's called Tanner graph of the code. It's a bipartite graph, so it consists of bits and checks. Well, what you see here in blue are ones, and the rest is zeros, and of course it looks ugly, and it's not, you know, the longest code used. Normally, well, depending on application, code should be 1,000 bits long, maybe 10,000 or even 100,000 bits long, so it may be seriously long. Okay, so that's just very brief.
Wait, can I just check? So if you receive a message and you check it in this way and it fails the parity check, then the idea is that you ask for the message to be sent again?
At the moment I'm not discussing how to use it. I'm discussing yet on the level of, let's say you are somewhere here. You are not yet, your message was not sent in the channel, but you just want to know the set of zeros and ones which you have in here. Was it really derived from what you had before decoder, before encoder?
Okay.
So, and what I'm saying is that not all possibilities of zeros and ones are allowed. Yeah. And that characterizes more or less this parity check matrix answer this question. If what you have in here is the result of, came through encoder or something imaginary. How to use it later for decoding, that's another story. We'll come to that. Okay?
So I have to, so that's related to the mechanism of the encoder, obviously.
It's related to mechanism of encoder, but the way it's represented through parity check is most useful for decoding. And it's you kind of started to guess why. Because if the result of application of this parity check to your message doesn't give you zeros, then at least you know that there is an error. And later on, you can actually correct it. But I'll be talking about that. Okay, so now decoding. The best you can possibly do is to do what's called maximum likelihood, or, well, there are various names used. What's maximum likelihood? That actually, in our statistical physics jargon, that would be kind of finding ground state. Let me explain what it means. So, as I told you, I know statistics of the channel, right? This sigma is one of these code words which I was explaining before. So, I don't know this code word. I know output. And what I can do, I can say that, fine, I don't know this code word, but I can, in principle, write a long list of all possible code words, 2 in the power 5, right? And just go through this list and find this one code word, possible code word, projected code word, which gives me maximum probability, right? Well, kind of clear why I'm calling it ground state, right? So you're taking argument of this maximum with respect to sigma, and that's your maximum likelihood. So you're getting the answer. Okay, so maximum likelihood is nice. There is something else which is very closely related, which is called maximum a posteriori. Don't ask me why this name, But more or less, in our jargon, that would be finding magnetization. Okay? Instead of finding just one of those possible sigmas, pre-images, you weight all of them with the weight which you know, right? And then the result will be, of course, not 0 and 1 or plus or minus 1, depending on what I use. It will be some number. But then you round it closer to 0 or closer to 1, or just take a sign in the case of plus or minus 1. By the way, I'll be talking in terms of plus or minus 1, the rest. And it will be primarily binary, even though some of the story actually the whole story can be extended to, let's say, pots, many states. Okay, so that's maximum likelihood, maximum posteriority. They're both good. Maximum likelihood is, of course, better. This is a little bit more, well, you can do more analytically with the thing. However, major drawback for both those things is that, well, you need to know the whole list, and it's exponentially large with respect to number of, you know, if L is 155 or 94 actually. In this example which I showed you, 2 in the power 94 is horrendous number, so you cannot really go through this list. So something else should be done. Yes?
Sigma is a vector, and so what do you mean by the sign of
that? All right. Well, a vector which consists of all those bits. So each individual component is a bit.
The question is on the right, you have to see.
Oh, well, I kind of put a loose notation. So you take sign element by element.
Mathematical.
Yeah. Okay, so now here comes belief propagation, which actually suboptimal but efficient decoding, which made those LDPC codes famous. And actually, Robert Gallagher introduced those codes in 61. Then they were forgotten. And you probably heard this, what's referred to as the turbo code revolution. Turbo codes, some other codes, which actually closely related to LDPC codes, which were experimentally, let's say, numerically introduced in early 80s. And then 90s. People, well, yeah, probably, yeah, you're right. Early 90s, right? And then people recall all those stories which they heard from Gallagher, and now it's, believed to be the best code known, and in many sense of this word. I'll not be giving you the whole projection of why those codes are good, but major message is that they're good because very efficient decoding exists. And this efficient decoding is called belief propagation or message passing, depending on the subfield. Now there is a nice, coincidence. We would call it beta piles, and you'll see why. And actually, it's clear why. So basically, I already said that major key thing about parity check matrix, which you need to get this LDPC code, is a sparseness, idea of sparseness. So locally, this graph, which I showed in the previous slide, is tree-like. So that's exactly the good thing about those codes. And in principle, you want to avoid this long loop. You cannot do it. And that's actually why my story, how to account for those loops. But what Robert Gallagher suggested, more or less, he said that, well, let's think of a tree. So this graph is a tree. Forget about loops. And on a tree, this computational complexity, which I mentioned before, exponentially large number of steps, is not an issue, right? We know that we can reduce complexity to a linear, and we know it under name of beta piles. And we do it, transfer matrix extended to a tree. We know how to do it. We start from leaves, and we propagate probabilities, right? So basically, instead of summing with respect to, summing, like in maximum posteriori, with respect to all those configurations, you formulate a set of relations, equations, if you wish, which you solve from peripheral to center of the tree, and you do it in parallel, right? And complexity is linear, so it's not a problem. Let me, I don't know if you feel comfortable with this statement, let me just, I'm not going to go through this algebra, but just, tell you a little bit more about this, reduction. So let's, by the way, this is, what we would call and what we call partition function, right? And that's more or less a statistical mechanics model, which I haven't here. So now let me tell a little bit more about this model, because it doesn't look like normalizing model or anything that you're used to. Okay, so this part are actually those constraints which I mentioned. So alphas, they are checks, I are bits, and basically in this I belong to alpha and product of alpha, this information about checking that all checks are satisfied is encoded. It's just set of Kronecker delta functions, if you use Kronecker conditions. So that's of course what makes it very kind of unsteady, uneising model like. This part is of course very familiar, right? That's more or less information about the probabilities. And here I explicitly assume that my channel is wide, so not correlated to different bits. And we can always present this probability, transition probability, in this form where H, well, if we use analogy with statistical physics, that would be like magnetic field. In information theory, they actually call it log likelihood. So this H tells you a bias for given bit. If a bit, you know, most probably positive or most probably negative. So if it is positive, HI is positive, then bit is most probably positive. Okay? So now think of that on a tree. What you do, you introduce, you basically cut a tree into subtrees. So maybe I should draw it here. Let's say I have subtree in this segment, then I have subtree in that segment, and they join together in this bigger subtree. Okay, that's what I'm telling you about. Now, let me define partition function on this subtree and partition function of this subtree. And the hint is that partition function of the entire thing can be expressed in terms of those two partition functions. That's a simple relation which we normally do when we solve this problem on a tree, right? Going from peripheral to the center. But now, well, that's what is written here in this algebra. So now, well, it works only on a tree. But what Gallagher suggested is, well, why not to use it on any graph? Well, of course, he was thinking mainly about graphs which are sparse. So he certainly had an idea, kind of intuitive idea, that it should work nicely or reasonably if somehow those loops are not important. But that was any case heuristics. And a part of my story is to explain why this heuristics is good and how to use it to improve it, to account for loops. Okay? So, well, I don't know, you can ignore this equation. That's actually, if you are familiar with this belief propagation or message passing business, that's how this set of equations which you get from this tree hierarchy look like. Actually, important thing is that when you write it down in this form, in terms of this partition function for those, of course, to derive it, you need a tree. But when you write it down as a set of equations, it's local conditions, and if you forget about why and how you derive it, you can really apply it to any graph. And that's, well, we actually know that it's often used, and it's called beta piles, even in the lattices, for computational purposes, and it's often much better than mean field. In a sense, it is a mean field of a special kind, and I'll tell you more on that on the next slide. So now, on a tree, a natural way to solve this hierarchy is to do iterative solution from leaves to center. On a graph, if you accept it, you don't need to accept it, but if you accept it, you actually don't know where to start because there are no leaves. So what they usually think of that, and they call it message passing algorithm, is actually iterative. Think of this equation as iterating it from left to right. And I'm now talking how it's actually implemented. These iterations on a tree, they certainly converge. Well, you just go from peripheral to the center. On any graph, it doesn't guarantee to be converging. But usually, they fix a certain number of iterations, and whatever you get as a result, and you're getting what they call a posterior log likelihood, if you wish magnetizations. They take it as granted. I also should mention that this type of approach actually applied to a general inference problem, of course, is very brute heuristics. And well, you have this intuitive idea that it works better if a graph is sparse, but you don't. Well, we'll see why it actually works, how it can be used on when loops are accounted for. Before going into this, later on, before moving further, let me, and since I mentioned this general problem of statistical inference, allow me to introduce even more general model than I used. And that's actually a formulation of Horney and Lelliger. It's all written here. So now allow me to put my variables not on bits as I had before, but on edges. Okay, so I have certain graph, and I have variables which are binary variables, so plus minus ones, and I don't distinguish direction. So you put, it actually was supposed to be, sigma 1, 2 is equal to sigma 2, 1. So now you put variables on edges, and you also, as a matter of notation, you introduce a vector, which in this case, sigma 1, consists of three components, sigma 1, 2, sigma 1, 4, sigma 1, 8. Okay? That's what I call vector sigma 1. So now allow me to consider the following model. So I know that's how my probability of a configuration is factorized. And it's factorized in this model in the following way. So it's a product of functions. Each and every of them is defined on vertices. So my variables lives on edges and functions lives on vertices. Okay? And those functions shouldn't be the same. They're arbitrary. So in normalizing model, ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic, these functions are very special and very fixed. So here, arbitrary, and for that matter, arbitrary magnetic field, arbitrary exchange in principle can be incorporated here. By the way, this model, which I was discussing before, model problem of statistical inference, decoding and error correction, of course, can be put in the same fashion, in the same way. Formally it's written here, but let me not discuss. So I'll be using actually this most general formulation and statistical sum. Partition function of this model is actually what I want to evaluate, calculate, and all things will be discussed in this in terms of partition function. Okay, as a matter of giving you a little bit more of details, which are actually more recent, is from 2001 on this belief propagation. Let me tell you that belief propagation, the way I formulated it, and the way Gallagher introduced it. It was, exact on a tree, but it wasn't clear at all why to use it in a context of a general graph with loops. So Edidio, Freeman, and Weiss actually showed that the set of equations which you are getting in this kind of ad hoc approximation is nothing but variational approach. So it can be understood in terms of a non-equilibrium free energy minimizing certain equilibrium free energy function. It's actually written down here. I wrote it down for this general model, which is described on the previous slide. I only want, you kind of probably it looks familiar. So this is what we would call, B is belief. Belief is your expectation for probability. So sigma A is this vector, which I introduced before, on a given vertex. So this is a functional of those functions which are beliefs, okay? And there are two types of beliefs. There are beliefs which sits on which are associated with the vertex, and beliefs which are associated with edges, okay? And this is self-energy. This is more or less entropy terms. And the statement is that if you take this functional, minimize it with respect to beliefs, then relation between those beliefs, because since, first of all, they are probabilities, so they should sum to one. And second of all, beliefs on edges and beliefs on vertices, they're of course related to each other. That's in here. So Lagrangian multipliers added to this free energy functional and minimize it. And that statement is that what you're getting belief propagation equations. Maybe just to make it really, you know, simple and clear, let me remind you briefly what's, you know, exact variational principle in statistical mechanics and what variational ansatz, which is used in this case, is. So in general, whenever we have a Gibbs measure, well, I can write anything in this exponent of minus energy, right? Statement is that if I introduce this functional, which is more or less beta free energy functional, non-equilibrium free energy, which is functional on belief, and that's self-energy, and that's entropy, and now if you do this variation under conditions that probability sum to 1, then this B is nothing but P, right? That's just reformulation. So, but now how to use it? You use it through variational ansatz. That's exact, but it's basically not useful, right, for your problem. But if you have an idea of how your probabilities are decoupled, and usually this idea comes from a factorization of energy, then you basically put it in. So standard mean field would be full factorization, right? So probability factorizes on different bits or edges depending on where you put your variables. It's a product of probabilities. Belief propagation is something along this line, but a little bit more sophisticated. So actually, formally, it's expressed in this way, I mean, this ansatz. So basically, what you see in here is that your original variables sit on, you remember, right? So I have this graph, oh, I don't know, any graph. And then my variable sits sitting, let's say, 1, 2 on edges. So now, when I introduce, first of all, this factorization, then I count each and every edge twice, right? Because there are two vertices. And that's why I'm dividing to this probability. That's kind of simple and intuitive. Okay, so in any case, that was very nice observation by Edith Freeman and Weiss, and you probably know Jonathan, right? So he is the only physicist, and Freeman and Weiss, in this group of people, Freeman and Weiss are computer scientists. But it's really important paper, so now it's well recognized and, you know, cited many times. I also should mention that actually a story of statistical physics in this information science, it's actually probably a long story. I should mention that Nicholas probably was one of the first who attracted our attention, I mean, people from statistical physics community to information, to error correction in his 89 paper, right, published in Nature. Also, mainly in recent years, statistical physicists focused on a kind of studying disordered problem. So in the context of error correction, you have not one graph, but many graphs, and you average with respect to graphs. I'll not be talking about that. That's just for reference. And okay, so now a little, well, nice remark is that, there is another type of decoding which is very nice for analysis, which is nothing but kind of low temperature approximation for this beta free energy. When your temperature is low, when your probabilities F are high, then those entropy terms, they're bounded, right? They're always bounded. They cannot be, each and every term cannot be larger than one. Well, this self energy, of course, grows. So why not to forget entropies at all? You still have very non-trivial part of the problem kind of embedded into these relations, into these conditions. And that's actually, they'll give you what's called linear programming decoding. Why it's linear programming? Well, because what you need to do, you need to minimize linear functional. Well, if you ignore entropies, this is linear, right? Under linear constraints, and that's problem is of polynomial type, so it can be solved efficiently, and there are very, very good, very good software available. So it's a nice remark, which actually, it was introduced. I mean, this linear programming was introduced without any reference to beta free energy by Feldman, Van Wright, and Kargerban, but it was realized later that it's actually most clearly seen from this beta free energy approach. Okay, I'm still this introductory stage. Okay, error flow. So that's actually something which is caused by approximate nature of belief propagation. So belief propagation is efficient decoding, and you trade it optimality for efficiency, right? So maximum likelihood is not feasible. You put this belief propagation, you know that it's most often works nicely, but sometimes there are problems. And those problems, there is a very clean understanding now that most important problem, which is due to imperfectness of belief propagation, is associated with a change of behavior of bit error rate with signal to noise ratio. So bit error rate, let me remind you, that's a characteristic of the entire scheme. So how many errors are you making? So you have the scheme, decoding, encoding, decoding as fixed, you have your favorite LDPC code, you have your favorite graph. Then decoding is this belief propagation, let's say, or linear programming, and you just collect statistics, for example, doing Monte Carlo, okay? And then you plot error rate, bit error rate versus signal to noise ratio, inverse temperature, and it decays, right? But it decays from what they call, a law of decay changes. And first it decays nicely, and there is even asymptotic prediction about how it decays, which is channel specific. But in any case, this is called waterfall. And then all of a sudden it changes to what's called error flow. So change of behavior. It's not saturation, but change of behavior. For Gaussian channel, which I'm discussing, it's actually change between, so asymptotically at large signal to noise ratio, low temperatures, those are two asymptotics which you expect. For maximum likelihood, this E to N is nothing but inverse temperature, okay? Think of that as inverse temperature. So there is some number divided by temperature, and here there is another number divided by temperature. So those numbers are different. And fact that your decoding is suboptimal is exactly in, this inequality. And of course you don't like it, but you first of all need to understand it. And then probably correct it. One little remark here is that it all sounds good, but with Monte Carlo you often cannot go low. You cannot go lower than 10 minus 8. You probably can do a little bit smarter thing with important sampling, but in any case, you cannot go that far. Very, very low. And very often, for at least for some while, people didn't see this change of behavior, and they declared that codes are nice, so there is no problem. But actually, there is always a problem, and one of our story is about how actually to, first of all, to understand this error flow, and second, to correct by improving decoding, by improving belief propagation, and how you can possibly think of improving belief propagation. Accounting for loops, which we didn't account for. When you derive belief propagation, which is exact on a tree but not exact on any graph. So that's more or less what in the rest of the talk. So I'll be telling you first of all I'll tell you how to I first of all need to tell you a little bit more on the way of introduction. This change of behavior, probably should return back. This change of behavior from waterfall to error flow happens, as already mentioned, at relatively low bit error rates. And low bit error rates means low probability. And we, of course, know very well, whenever we are discussing low probability, those are rare events which are important here, right? So, instant, if you wish. Optimal fluctuations. So that's idea behind analysis of this thing. So you want to find those rare instances, in doing so, you instead of the bit error rate is an integral with respect to all possible noises, right? But different configuration noises are different. And you want to find this very special one, or maybe few configuration of the noise, which are giving a major contribution into this object, most dangerous configurations. So, when we came to this field, we said, oh, nice. So we call them instantons, but later on we figure out that people had certain names, another name for that. They call it pseudocode words. And it's clear why they call it pseudocodewords, because normally, if belief propagation succeeds, you decode to code word, to something which was actually sent before. That's a success. But if you decode to, well, you can check that if you decoded to code word or not. And if you decode not in a code word and you're kind of stuck there, well, they call it pseudocodeword. So something which is fictitious, which is not really code word. And that's a primarily feature of suboptimal decoding, feature of belief propagation. Okay? I'll not be telling you how we analyze, well, we develop, well, at least two different techniques for finding those, well, we call them instantons, but, well, you can say pseudocodewords. I'll not be telling you the story, even though I'll be very happy to comment on that later. What I'll be doing, I'll be discussing next step. Once you have those code words, how to use them for analysis and in the future for improvement of belief propagation. So I want to analyze those troublemakers, understand from a point of view of loops their importance, and then hopefully to reduce error flow by improving belief propagation, improving this decoding. Okay, so now, well.
Can I just check? So you said that there's a regime that's inaccessible to Monte Carlo simulations. Does that regime include anything that's important for practical application?
Absolutely. Well, I mentioned 10 minus 8, 10 minus 9 is the best you can possibly do with Monte Carlo. So target for fiber optics application is 10 minus 12, I mean current target. So that's what you need is a bit error rate so you need at least two or three orders of magnitude. And for magnetic recording, so what you have on CD or DVD, it's 10 minus 15. So you really need to have some smart idea about those pseudocodewords or instantons, which you can later on actually use in Monte Carlo. So that's smart important sampling, right? But you need to get those instanton pseudocodewords.
Be easier to code redundantly?
Well, it depends on application. So sometimes you can indeed repeat if you communicate to satellite and which is very far and you just care. Not you don't care about flow of information, but about this information to be delivered. Fine, yeah, you're right. You just repeat many, many times. But in the communications you were you really want to send as much information as you can with a fixed rate. So you cannot introduce more redundancy than is, well, let's say, one half, twice more. You cannot be twice more redundant than, So then this redundancy rate is fixed, and you need to do something, and that's exactly the... So it's a nice... Well, you should think of that. In statistical physics, we have this lattice, right? And lattice is given because we have material, and, well, we are stuck with that. Here, it's really a new world, so you everything is at your disposal. I mean, a graph, you can change it. You need to do it smartly, but that's more or less the name of the game, yeah. Okay, so now let me tell you about this theoretical thing, which is certainly way more important than a particular, well, it's more general than a particular application which I'm discussing, but, well, I use this opportunity to tell you about error correction because I think it's a nice application. So now what I'll be telling you is what we call loop calculus. Loop calculus is nothing but a way to reparameterize the partition function, and that's exact. Relation which I'll be discussing. So what you have on the left is the model which I introduced before, and that's a particular graph, just as an example. So now what I'll be telling you is that there is exact way to reformulate it in the following form. It's major statement here is that it's a sum with respect to what we call generalized loops. How we think of those generalized loops? Just think about coloring of the graph. I have I'm now introducing subgraphs, and those subgraphs, they are basically I color edges, and by coloring an edge, I also color a vertex. So now the rule is for generalized loop is that you allowed anything which doesn't have loose ends. Okay, not even a single loose end is allowed. And for this particular graph, there are 14 examples. Well, I don't know if you can see it. So those subgraphs are in bold. So that's as many. So basically, for this graph, I have 14 terms in this sum. Well, maybe just to make it a little bit more clear. So if I color just one edge, I have two loose ends, not colored, not allowed. So this is still not allowed, right? But this is okay. So that's a normal single, you know, simple loop. However, this type of configuration, for example, would be also allowed. This is not allowed. If I have this configuration, and let's say that configuration, some other part of the graph, they're allowed, I mean, as independent configuration, but combination of them is yet another configuration. That's more or less what, you know, what includes in the sum. Well, I am not familiar with my expansion. So it's actually, you'll see that it's in simple case of, let's say, Ising model in a paramagnetic phase with zero magnetic field, let's say. That would be just high temperature expansion. But the first term is non-trivial. And more or less what I'll tell you is that the first term is nothing but this belief propagation, which I was discussing before. And more than that, everything in this expression right-hand side, Z naught and RCs, they're all expressed in terms of the solution of belief propagation. Remember, the one which I was formulating as a set of equations, or the solution of variational equations. And yeah, by the way, that's explicit expression for each and every of these terms in terms of belief propagation. So mu's are certain, actually very simple, irreducible correlation functions, and M, which you see in here, is nothing but magnetization. Well, I already said that in a trivial case of Ising model in paramagnetic phase, that will be just high temperature expansion, which we can do on a finite graph, right? We don't need to be infinite, to have infinite graph. But it's really non-trivial because, well, anywhere else, let's say in the low temperature phase, or for that matter, in any problem of the type, any of these problems, which are the general problem I discussed, because the bare approximation itself, belief propagation, is extremely non-trivial. Okay, so now let me tell you very briefly how, well, this derivation sketch, which is, I think, cute by itself. So it's actually about introducing gauge transformation and then fixing this gauge. So belief propagation becomes a very special way to fix a gauge. And I'm not integrating with respect to gauge. It's just a parameter which I introduce. But it's continuous degree of freedom. And I have a lot of those. Well, basically, it's a local gauge. So you introduce it. You introduce two parameters at each and every edge. So, and let me do it in a very algebraic way, so you see how it works. And then we can, you know, of course it's, well, there is an invariant way to present it, but let me do it in a very kind of brute force, straightforward algebraic way. And by the way, it's not how we derive it. We derive it in an ugly way through introducing functional integral representation, getting some saddle points there, making sure that saddle point is belief propagation, then analyzing corrections, and then figuring out that we can actually do it much nicer and, you know, without integrals. Okay, so what I do, remember I started by saying, well, I actually, when I introduced model, I said that I have variable per edge, and sigma 1, 2 was, and sigma 2, 1 was the same. So now let me distinguish them. And of course, I'm doing that just by introducing Kronecker symbol in case of this binary variable. That's more or less what is in here. If sigma BC is equal to sigma CB, I'm getting zero. If they're not equal to zero, and if they're equal to one, just Kronecker symbol. Okay. So now there is this interest. Well, I cannot say it's non-trivial. It's actually very simple. But well, in our context, the way we apply it, it becomes non-trivial. So that's a relation which you would have for this one plus sigma one, sigma two, P and sigma. And that's just algebraic expression. But important thing is that it's valid for any sigma and p, plus or minus 1. And eta and chi, they're continuous fields, continuous variables, any variables. Well, what you should pay attention here to is that this structure 1 plus beast, which consists of a product of tanh minus sigma, tanh minus p, it's actually, well, tanh is very appropriate, right? But in any case, that's exact relation, and now what you do, you plug it in this formula instead of all those things, and of course you use different eta fields. Well, you have two fields per h according to this expression. Okay, so that's just, you know, straightforward algebra. So you rewrite your z in this form. So this factor, prefactor, you put it, you take it outside. Well, that's more or less this part. It doesn't depend on your discrete variables, so you can take it off the sum easily, right? I'm talking about calculating partition function. That's outside. So now, then there are two effects. So first of all, those functions f, which are factor functions on vertexes, they're renormalized. So now instead of f, I'm getting what I call here p, and this is renormalization. But more importantly, you're getting a product of all this 1 plus, 1 plus, 1 plus. It's actually, well, it's written down in here. So this product of 1 plus, 1 plus, and of course this, what is on, you know, in the plus side is each and every time different. You can express in terms of 1 plus sum over, you can think of all those terms as different colorings, right? Because whenever you pick one from a particular contribution, you don't color it. Whenever you pick something else, I mean this non-trivial part, you color it. Now, hint is that this is valid, I mean, this is what you started from for any gauge field. Let me call them gauge field. So now I'm going to use this freedom to fix gauge. And what I can do, I can enforce this no loose ends constraint. Okay? Basically, I can just enforce the fact that any colorings which would have at least one single, at least one loose end would be zero just by construction. That's more or less how it works. And remarkable thing that you're getting from that exactly this belief propagation equation. I mean, just from this gauge fixing condition.
So how many conditions do you have?
Yeah.
Sense?
Well.
No.
You have two conditions per edge, because.
Because you can have loose ends on both sides.
Right. And you have two fields. Yeah, two variables. Actually, I learned not to call them fields because, well, there are a lot of mathematics in this field. I mean, and field would mean something else. Well, we just call, they, well, we introduce it, so we are okay to call it gauge fixing. Okay, so no loose ends. Now, interesting thing is that you can also understand that in terms of variational principle. What you should do, you in this sum, allow me just to forget about all those colorings and pick one, okay, without fixing those gauges yet. And then let me require, of course, the full thing, Z, didn't depend on those gauge fields. But whenever I drop all those terms and pick only one, of course, the result, which let me call Z naught, will depend on gauges. So now let me require that locally it doesn't depend. So let me do this variational thing. And well, believe it or not, this will give the same belief propagation thing. So those two are kind of complementary. And it's just a straightforward algebraic check that they give the same result. So now, once you fix gauges and once you set... Oops. Sorry. Once you fix gauges, once you substitute it back in expression which you saw in the previous transparency, then you're getting this nice formula. So this formula more or less telling you, suggests a factorization in terms of loops. So, of course, you immediately see that if you would have a tree, you would not have a single term, just first term. But if you have, well, in this case, 14 generalized loops, well, you have 14 terms, and you need to deal with that. So that's a, well, very general formula, and we are not aware of, you know, this formula being derived before. So it's probably very, very useful in various contexts. But
what's an expression?
Oh yeah. Okay. So those RCs, they expressed in terms of observables. Okay. So this mu. Okay. You have. Let me discuss this particular color term. Right. So one term which is associated with this loop. So this is actually a single connected loop. So each and every edge have two colored, each and every vertex have two color edges adjusted. So then I need to calculate irreducible correlation function. So I know those beliefs. Beliefs is the solution of this belief propagation of beta Pyrrhus equation. So then I just need to sum. Well, I put integral, but of course it's sum. It's just for, you know, convenience of notation. So I need to calculate this irreducible correlation function. Those are just numbers. And in this case, will be 1, 2, 3, 4. Four vertexes, four numbers of that type, and I need to take product of all those irreducible correlation function along the loop. And then I should divide by product of this, all the simple expressions formulated, found in terms of, well, expressed, formulated in terms of magnetization. So it's basically for each and every loop. Point is that you may still, well, computational point important for computational complexity issue. I'm not saying that I solved a problem of reducing exponentially difficult problem of calculating partition function to, you know, something which is feasible in algebraic number of steps. A number of terms will be still exponential, and what to do with this formula is another, you know, is yet to be discussed. So number of terms will be exponential, but for each and every term, first of all, I can classify all those terms. And second of all, for each and every term associated with a certain loop, I can just write down the number. Okay, so now let me...
Excuse me.
Oops. Can I have another 5 minutes?
How long?
Huh? How long?
5 minutes? Yeah, sure.
Well, 5 minutes, I'll briefly tell you how to use this thing in the context of error correction.
Yeah.
And then I'll close.
If you have a graph which corresponds to sparse matrix, can you estimate the number of the loops?
Okay.
So this is a graph problem.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You know, can I postpone discussion of that later? It's wide open. So that's actually well, main reason I'm talking here. I'm looking for any feedback on that. So this type of thing can be used in various problems. My you know, preliminary answer is that it depends on the problem. So I mean, it depends on the problem. Well, for some problems, one particular loop can be important to account, and that's it, just one loop. And that's actually a problem which I'll be discussing today. But for other problems, and probably there are many of that type in spin class, you'll need to count for many loops, and how many, that's an open question. It probably depends on the problem. Okay, so now let me show you how it works in error correction. And specifically for, first of all, understanding this problem of error flow. Remember what I was telling you, that error flow is due to imperfectness of belief propagation. But now, belief propagation is basically ignoring all those loops in calculating, let's say, partition function. So just taking z-naught, first term. And we know that it decodes wrong. So it decodes, well, at least in this error flow business, well, there are all those failures, and they're because I didn't account something important which somehow in the rest. So the idea, first of all, would be because in the previous, you know, analysis we found for this particular problem, which was, you know, Tanner graph that big, 155 bits. For this particular error correction code, we actually have a list. It was close to 200 of those pseudocode words which we found. We knew them. So then go through this list one by one and see how it shows, how those troublemakers show themselves in terms of loops. And a statement, which is actually a remarkable statement, that was our guess in the beginning, but we of course didn't hope that it will be working so nicely. Basically, the statement is that for all of them, for all those 200 troublemakers, there exists a simple loop, just one loop, which is most important. And most important means that it's either exactly equal to one or very close to one in terms of this expression for partition function. There is just one thing. And that's, for example, which is, the lowest instanton. Well, I don't have time to go into details, but more or less what you see in here is, bits versus a result of decoding. So if it would be, I sent plus one, so that was my code word. So now it decoded in this mess, and actually this was all the mess, part of the mess. So minus one is wrong, plus one would be good, but it decoded in something which is scattered. So now, for this particular configuration, you can see that there is a loop which sits on four bits and the gears of the code. So shortest loop is, the length of the shortest loop is called gears. So it goes through four, at least four. Well, length of the shortest gears is four in this case. So there are four bits where you can actually form this, what we call critical loop. So that was. And well, it works nicely, as I said, for all those troublemakers which we found before. Okay.
Where did the statement of unusual check that said for every instanton a loop exists?
Yes.
How about the converse? For every loop you have an instanton?
That I don't know. Probably. Probably, but important thing is that not all instantons are equally dangerous. So they have certain weight, number. In this case, it's kind of coded in this number. So 20, if I'm in between the 6.4 and 20, that's a window where I really care about instantons. Okay. Yes, this 20 is related to Hamming distance of the code. But in terms of bit error rate, you remember I was discussing bit error rate as a function of signal to noise ratio or temperature. So, and I was telling you that asymptotically at temperature going to zero, it has this form, E over minus E over T, right? Activation kind of form. So now I'm discussing this number basically. And if I would have ideal decoding, it's known for this code, that number should be 20. So all those instantons, or pseudo code words with a number which is less than, it's actually D, not E here, sorry, with number which is less than 20 are dangerous. And we found by other methods, which I'm not describing today, at least, 200 of them, approximately 200 of them. And I'm saying that for each and every of those troublemakers, I can go to this loop calculus and see that there is always a critical loop which gives contribution which is either exactly one or very close to one.
This is a bit close. So I thought you were doing this loop calculus to have another way of calculating dangerous configurations.
No. Well, maybe it can be used for that, but I'm not doing this. So we had some other method of finding those troublemakers, which has nothing to do with loop calculus. Troublemakers, they come from an approximate decoding, which is belief propagation, which doesn't account for loops. So the logic is different. So we have some other method which gave us these troublemakers. So we check with loop calculus what is exactly problematic in those troublemakers if we ignore this part. Okay? And then, I'm coming to next step, which will be basically the last thing which I want to say. Yes. Configuration of troublemakers, how do I explain them? I am explaining them in terms of configuration of the noise, which is dangerous. Okay, so if given noise means in terms of factor function, those factors which I have on vertexes, okay? So I can, in principle, for given configuration of these factor functions, check, well, analyze those loops. Okay, so in any case, I actually jumped. All right, so now the idea is to use it to improve belief propagation. So we know that for each and every of these problematic troublemakers, there is some loop we need to account for. So let's do that, and let's really use loop calculus. How? Well, we know this loop. And by the way, loop is noise specific, so factor function specific. So basically, suggestion is to use it in terms of what we call loop-corrected belief propagation algorithm. You run belief propagation. If belief propagation works, you're happy, you're done. If it doesn't work, then you need to find this critical loop. Once critical loop is found, well, you have a simple test. If the result is a code word, then it works. Well, of course, there are errors which would be some other code words, but you cannot correct them even with maximum likelihood, right? So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about those errors which are in principle can be corrected. So you run, if belief propagation doesn't work and there is a simple way to test it, then you identify this critical loop, return back to your original formulation with gauges, and use this variational principle for fixing gauges in a different way. And the idea is that belief propagation is formulated as, well, in variational way, as just picking first term of this, you know, expansion before gauges are fixed and requiring that variation of it is zero. But now we do know this G, this gamma, this critical loop for given configuration. So we can just change belief propagation equation and formulate them in this modified way. So it will be new choices of gauges, and basically it will be the same belief propagation equations everywhere but along this critical loop. It's what we call loop-corrected belief propagation, and there is even simpler version of it, which we call loop linear programming erasure, which is, you remember, linear programming has a certain limit of belief propagation. So in any case, a remarkable thing is that it did work for all those 200 troublemakers. So next step, we are now trying to, and that's with Misha Stepanov, we are trying to write a code and actually to optimize it and run it with Monte Carlo, but it's not yet done. Hopefully in a few months it will be done. Now the general conjecture is that it's not clear if you can, probably will not be able to reduce the error flow completely, so we'll not be able to go from this, for this code, from 16.4 to really 20. Maybe, I just don't want to be over optimistic, but at least we can seriously reduce it, and that's basically one very special use of this loop calculus. Okay, so I think I'm done. There are of course many things to do, and I just listed something, some subjects which are kind of related to error correction. I also wanted to mention that there are, now this question of how to count loops in general in statistical mechanics problem became kind of, there are two groups, Andrea Montanari and Rizzo and Parisi and Flanina. They actually discuss it they discuss it primarily in the context of Ising model, and it was just very kind of, different approach, and I think we have a stronger statement, more general way of doing it. But any case, I just wanted to refer it, and probably there is a lot of potential in, joining those different techniques. So that's it, and here's the bibliography. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Right. Okay. Well,
no. Coming back to this question,
this
component, the combinatory. So,
you mean to use this?
If you take the outer serene, do you have an estimation of the cause of
Does it exist, or you have an estimation of the number?
Well, are you asking about how to use this loop calculus to get this number, or how? Because
I mean, the question is a combinatorial question. It has nothing to do with how many what you call
generalized loops.
Yes.
Well, I didn't think of that yet. Actually, I should mention that. Well, this form 1 plus sum over RC is a nice one, but it's probably can be reduced even further. For example, in this period of, what Michael Fisher was doing many years, right, in the context of high temperature expansion. Fisher and collaborators. So, well, for example, if you are discussing kind of dilute gas of loops, right, so loops which are single connected loops, and you don't care about these rare configurations where loops intersecting, then you of course can factorize it. You can write it as a product, and here will be kind of single connected loops, etc. So there are many things which probably can be done with this formula further, but very well. It's wide open, so we didn't do anything yet in this period.
More questions?
Do you have a simple explanation why this really progresses? Because in your formula, what is surprising is that this RC just comes from the beat, right?
That's right. That's a non-trivial part. So you can express full...
Is RC coming?
You can estimate out of the, usually you make an approximation, you get it wrong. I mean, it doesn't tell you what you should do next. You cannot compute the correction out of the basic thing. But here it looks like you can
Right. So that's actually why belief propagation is, if you wish, fundamental. So it's not just an approximation, but that's a way to factorize a full expression. You're asking how to explain it intuitively? Well, I think this gauge fixing is, well, it sounds intuitive for me, but I don't have, and this variational thing is also kind of, well, already previous results, so we did a Freeman Weiss, that belief propagation, which people thought of as a just solution on a tree, is actually more than that, is a really nice variation. And by the way, Didier Freeman-Weiss used certain technique to improve it, basically by reformulating problem in terms of other graph, you know, doing maximum likelihood in not on defining what could be called super vertex or super, or they call it regions, and doing maximum likelihood within. So basically, doing kind of coarse graining thing. On a certain scale, doing honest thing, maximum likelihood, and then doing belief propagation on a larger scale. So already from that, I mean, from variational formulation, well, it was a good hint. But here you just see that belief propagation is fundamental because it's gauge fixing condition. It allows you this selection. Yes.
It's not exactly about this topic, it's about maybe some other application of what we've done. There is a long-standing problem in under-centralization, which how does under-centralization look like in very high dimension? So, there is a solution on the getting large, which nobody knows, what does it tell us about. Because you can't say, oh, okay, this is infinite dimension. On the other hand, it has never been done any extension to big but finite them. So, and the principal difficulty is taking into account loops.
Exactly.
So what I'm asking is, how do you think, could your machinery provide
a way to make one of the expansion in that world?
No, no, thank you. Yeah, it's a very good question. Actually, well, I mentioned paper of Parisi. And what Parisi is doing for Ising model is using a method of Ifetov from 90, which Ifetov formulated exactly to the problem which
yeah,
you mentioned.
Ifetov never did one of
the... That's right, that's right. Ifetov never did that, right. But that was exactly the point for Parisi to pick up on the method and then try to account for loops. So what we are saying, we know a better way of doing it. Yeah, so I agree with you that it sounds like a good approach, it's Parisi-Slanina, it's last year, 2005. Yeah, it is, well, this one. But Parisi was not discussing, so there were no super symmetry in here. So Parisi was discussing just Ising model.
It loops. How, in principle, they can do account loops.
Right. So Parisi tried to reformulate it in terms of extended field theory, so even bigger field theory. And the major problem in this paper is that they're getting belief propagation as a saddle point, but there are a lot of zero modes. And what they do is they just do, perturbative correction, just first diagram correction. Ignoring all those diverging and saying that they somehow remarkably cancel each other.
So basically, you answered to my question is positive. It could be the way.
I think so.
Connection with large B expansion model by Yevnivia and George. And this was in the.
Right. Well, another thing is that that's probably actually that's right. So that's that's right. So Edidi and George, they try to extend high temperature expansion to low temperature phase.
They did large D.
Having this large D, right. Right, large D and high temperatures are, of course, intimately related. So what I'm telling you is that there is this way of doing it, which is probably useful. Also, well, another connection to spin glass, I mean, to glassy problem in principle, is through, there is this approach, which is called cavity method, right? And cavity method, what is that? Is you take just belief propagation. Just belief propagation, no discussion of loops. And then you already, averaging this belief propagation equation, you have a lot of problem in cavity, a certain approximation. And then you do, improvement on the cavity. Well, it's replica symmetric. There are no replicas there. It's actually why it's nice, right? but there are various approximation. And once this business is settled, and well, probably, Parisi and Mizard would say that they kind of solve it on the level of belief propagation equation. Then on the real lattice, on for that matter on the real graph, you need to count for loops, and I also think that that's a good technique to do it.
If not, let's thank Michel for this.